Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Kevin Dunn. He's a political science professor at Hobart and William Smith Colleges and an expert on sub-Saharan Africa, in particular the Great Lakes region. He's also been a visiting professor at Mbarara University of Science and Technology in Western Uganda. Professor Dunn is the author or co-author of several books on Africa, including African Guerrillas, Raging Against the Machine, Imagining the Congo, Politics of Origin in Africa, and Inside African Politics. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, I thought we'd concentrate our conversation on sub-Saharan Africa, basically the southern three-quarters of the continent that sits below that ring of nations across the north that I think often gets treated with the Middle East when people are talking about things. But I wanted to focus on this area of sub-Saharan Africa and ask you first, if one goes by the coverage that you see in the mass media, I think the impression that one gets is that Africa kind of just goes from one disaster to another. Is that impression correct?
No, not at all. That is the the typical coverage that you see in Western popular press. But it reflects, of course, there are some severe crises across the continent in specific countries. But most Africans' daily lives are not characterized by war, famine, insecurity. And I think probably what should be stressed is in 2014, this is a continent that is growing, that it's one of the fastest growing economies in the world. And the kind of the image that people have from the 80s and 90s of a kind of stagnant economic continent kind of collapsing isn't true. You see a rising middle class. You see active development across the continent. And there's interesting reasons for that.
You mentioned a couple of big trends there. I wanted to ask you about those in this area. So in terms of politics and society, how would you characterize the overall trends of the continent or this part of the continent?
We're talking around 50 countries, so it's hard to generalize. But one would see that overall you see continuing hybridization of democratic regimes, which means that you've got countries that are fairly stable, that have the trappings of democracy, political liberalization, holding elections, but still a strong ruling government that's not opening itself up to free and fair elections generally. But that provides a fair amount of stability across the continent, but it also means that when things break down, they tend to break down quite dramatically, like you would see in the Central African Republic, Southern Sudan, and places like that.
And what about social norms? Has there been an overall trend? Are these becoming more what we would think of, for lack of a better word, as more westernized or liberal? Or what's going on there?
Yeah, I think what I would characterize it as, especially in the past decade, two decades I've been traveling to the continent, the thing that's probably most remarkable is seeing an emergent middle class across the continent, and one that is recognizable to you and I and to the listeners. The rise of shopping malls, people with cell phones are ubiquitous across the continent, recognizable restaurants that you and I might recognize, like a McDonald's here and so forth. And so that's probably the most noticeable increase or dramatic social change, I would say, that's happened in the past two decades.
And what would you attribute then to this popular impression that comes from the media that you're dismissing? I mean, what would you attribute that to? Is it just the media's tendency to focus on tragic things?
I think so. I think a combination of a couple of things. One, it's, the headline's not going to run that a free and fair and boring election took place today in Botswana. That's not going to catch anyone's headlines. And so I think most of the coverage is going to focus on those kind of crises because that's what leads. But also I think there's a longer kind of representation of Africa that even goes back to colonialism, is that this is a continent that doesn't work. And that was the justification over 100 years ago for colonial intervention. It was justification throughout the Cold War of why the United States, former colonial power, should be intervening. So there's this kind of overall mindset or worldview that this is a continent that doesn't work. And so those images of collapse, of political turmoil, get characterized in that. In ways that, if the Ukraine civil war that has been unfolding not civil war, but Ukraine unrest was taking place in Africa, the coverage would be much different, right? Mm-hmm. The tone would be much different. There would be conversations around perhaps regional and ethnic divisions within Ukraine that you're not seeing, right, as typifying that coverage, but you do in most African cases.
And what would you say for you as an observer, you think are the brightest spots and the most encouraging developments in sub-Saharan Africa over, say, this time period in which you're referencing?
I think what always impresses me, has always impressed me since being a student of the continent, is the way in which individuals on the ground make life work, right? They find ways to survive and to flourish. So that's at the very micro level. In terms of continent-wide, I mentioned Botswana. Botswana is a frequent case that people – you don't hear about Botswana. Botswana is a functioning democracy. It's probably one of the most stable democracies in the world. It has been for decades. No one really talks about Botswana because it's kind of boring. And it's been developing and it's doing well economically. You also see economic growth across the continent. One of the examples I like to give is there's the country of Angola, which was a Portuguese colony. And today, the Angolans are actually investing in the Portuguese economy. Oh. So there's a lot of investment coming from Angola, going back into Portugal. And one of the reasons that the Portuguese economy is doing as well as it is under these relative situations is because Angola investments are happening, which is an interesting story, but also flies in the face of that image of Africa as a troubled continent needing Western assistance.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Kevin Dunn, a political science professor at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, who specializes in sub-Saharan Africa. A couple questions for you about the Obama administration now. Despite a difference in some of the tone of the rhetoric, the Obama administration's foreign policy in the Middle East has arguably been in many ways a continuation of that of the Bush administration. Has its policies in sub-Saharan Africa been marked by more of a clear departure?
No, I think that there's two things that have been driving U.S. foreign policy under the Obama administration as well as the George W. Bush administration. And both – one predates 2001. That is an interest in natural resources, predominantly oil. The United States gets a very large amount of oil from Angola, from Nigeria. There's new oil reserves found throughout the continent. Uganda is going to start producing oil. Sudan produces oil, southern Sudan. So American interest in Africa has largely been driven for the last two decades or more by oil interest in other natural resources, but predominantly oil in Africa and across Africa. And the second is its concern about terrorism. And this, I think, really moved to the top of the agenda post-September 11th. There was obviously some concern about terrorism and Islamist terrorists after the bombing of the embassies in Nairobi in Kenya and Dar es Salaam in Tanzania that was predated September 11th. But after that, I think first the Bush administration and then the Obama administration, that's one of their main engagements. They're concerned about the spread of Islamist terrorists in West Africa, in places like Mali and Nigeria, and in East Africa coming out of Somalia.
I want to come back to that issue of the Muslim population in this part of the world. But let me stick with this topic here first. I was curious to know, thinking about the African nations and the people in Africa that you've encountered in their impressions of Obama in terms of the foreign policy of the United States, I was curious to know whether there's some perhaps disappointment in the administration since he is the first African-American president, that there wasn't then more of a change.
Yeah, I think so. I think – I remember I was actually in Uganda and in South Africa soon after his election. And there was in both cases, I think it represented across the continent, a kind of excitement, you know, that someone of African heritage is now the president of the United States and that this would somehow reflect a substantial change in terms of relations between the United States and the continent. And I think that faded fairly quickly. And I think now people just – Obama is the American president and the American government in the United States is the just kind of a very large hegemonic power in the world for good and ill.
If you could change something about our foreign policy toward this area of the world, what would it be?
Oh, I think one of our responses, our kind of obsession with the concern of a possible terrorist threat, has led us to have a really militarized response to Africa. We have American troops throughout the continent. We use the continent as a base for launching drone attacks. And so, unfortunately, our engagement with African states has been a kind of led by the military. And one of the things that's done is that our aid going into Africa and African states has often been military aid. So we're supporting regimes in power and supporting militaries who are in power that might not be the most reflective of the citizens' needs and, in fact, can be a source of incredible insecurity for those citizens.
I wonder if that's not in some ways perhaps a continuation of the Cold War mentality, because my impression is that a lot of our policy toward Africa at that time was driven by, well, you know, we want to make sure that the Russians, the Soviets don't have more control here. And then that drove some of the decisions about who we'd support and not support.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, both in terms of the mind frame that's leading it. And also the reality is that over an administrative change, we're still talking about the same level of bureaucrats at the kind of local mid-level who've already made contact with the Nigerian army, you know, or people in the Kenyan army, Ugandan army. So these personal connections are maintained, and they're quite strong. That's one of the ways in which the U.S. engages in Africa is through the kind of African militaries, and it has been for a long time. But again, as you pointed out, that's nothing that was true with the Soviets as well, and it's true for the French, for example, as well.
My guest is Professor Kevin Dunn. Professor Dunn teaches at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. He's an expert on Africa, and he's the author of Imagining the Congo, among other books. Well, I want to come back to this question of Muslims in sub-Saharan Africa. You mentioned the concern about the terrorist threat. Sub-Saharan Africa does have a large Muslim population. What has been their experience on the continent in recent years?
You know, there's been a large Muslim population for centuries. So the presence of Muslims in West Africa and East Africa has been there for in many ways longer than Christianity and rival Christian missionaries. So this is not a new development. The experience that Muslims have in Africa, or Muslim Africans, is extremely varied. And I would say there's I stress one interesting thing that's actually developed is that with the wave of democratization that occurred in Africa and elsewhere around the world after the collapse of the Cold War, there was this wave of democratization. And 1990s, early 21st century, what happened was actually the democratization allowed the Muslim population to engage with democratization in ways that was able to liberalize and further the Muslim population. So it's not antithetical between Islam and democracy. And in Africa, we see Muslim groups, civic groups, organizations using democracy to their own advantage. It's the ones, and again, a very small minority who have been left out of this kind of political liberalization who've turned to violence. And those are the ones that kind of grab the world's attention. Boko Haram is a group in northern Nigeria, a very small, very marginal, left out of the political system, the democratic political system, and have turned to violence. Akim, which is the Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, which comes out of Algeria, it spreads across West Africa. Very small, very isolated, but they're the terrorist threat that Americans are concerned about. And then Al-Shabaab in Somalia, which is the collapse of the Somalian system is kind of related to the rise of Al-Shabaab there.
Is there though, the same concern that you do see around the Middle East that these groups or the movement can really become, you know, a governing force, can actually take control of the reins of the state? And is that not the same threat there then in that part of the world?
There is that. I mean, there's the real concern in Mali when the Islamists, and they're largely coming from mercenaries who are leaving Libya and coming back into Mali, took the opportunity to almost overthrow the state. And they were driven back by the Malian government, the Malian military, and the French intervention force. The bigger concern, I think, in terms of seizing the reins of the state was Somalia, when actually Islamists did actually control Somalia and Mogadishu. The irony is that many Somalians kind of look back at that as that was the only time in the last 15, 20 years that there was some order in Mogadishu, right? As bad as the Islamists might have been in terms of the practices that they were enacting against us Somalians, at least we had things that were functioning. And so they were actually driven out by interventionist force from African Union. Ugandans, Kenyans, Ethiopians have all gotten involved. And al-Shabaab's kind of the remnant of this Islamist group who very much would like to retake control of the state and turn it into an Islamist state.
Now, the nations that you've been looking at a lot lately are Uganda, the Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The violence in the Congo has been in the news a lot over the years, and just recently Congress held hearings on this problem. So what is the overall situation there, briefly?
And briefly, most of the Congo is totally at peace and calm. Most of the violence is in the eastern part of the Congo, and that has to do with very long tradition of land rights and pressure, population pressures and access to land that's been exacerbated by regional powers getting involved, mainly Uganda and Rwanda, as well as international interest in terms of extracting minerals from the region. And so it's been you have a collection of militias. Basically, the state has broken down in that area many, many years ago. And in their place became what we call regional big men with armed militias who kind of created fiefdoms for themselves. And there has been no ability to assert state control in the region. And to the extent that the state, the Congolese state, does exert influence in the region, it does so in a way that's really, really negative. You come across reports of sexual violence against women and rapes, and a lot of those, if not the majority, have been carried out by the Congolese army itself. So the state's not seen as some kind of source of security and stability.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with political science professor and Africa expert Kevin Dunn. Well, what about the other two countries you've been looking at lately, Uganda and the Central African Republic? Briefly, what's going on there?
Well, the Central African Republic is a very difficult story to tell quickly. It's a landlocked country that's very resource-rich, but it's been a number of resources have been extracted by the French and other interests. It's been preyed upon by neighboring Chad and Sudan, as well as Uganda and Congo have all been involved throughout the decades in terms of political intrigue. There's been no stable government there, and there's been basically a rotating of elites within the Central African Republic trying to establish themselves in power.
What about Uganda then? What's going
Uganda,
on?
The Uganda situation is, and this has been building up, and it's a story of the anti-homosexual legislation that's been passed by Parliament that the president Museveni has signed into power, and there's been it's been a long time coming. It's actually a law that was written by American evangelicals in Uganda and has worked its way up. And Museveni has, I would say, very cleverly in terms of his political maneuvering, has now signed it into law in a way that he kind of built on this kind of anti-Western sentiment that the West can't tell us what to do because there was a lot of international pressure for him not to sign it. But at the same time, what he signed was actually an incredibly watered-down bill from the original. So he's able to turn to the West and say, good thing I was here. Because I was able to water it down for you, right? So I'm your ally, even though I will now tell the Ugandan people, be very critical of the West. He can turn to the West and say, good thing I was here. I actually, have some concerns that I share with you. So he's a very clever political survivor, Museveni is.
I imagine in the travels for your work, you've had some pretty memorable encounters, perhaps some of them frightening, others heartbreaking. Are there any experiences that most stay with you when you come back to the States?
That's a tough question, and that gets in probably into some kind of more personal reflections of individuals that I know who are no longer here. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's probably what I carry are individuals who I've met along the way who either are no longer with us because they were killed through violence or died through disease, whether it was AIDS or cancer.
Mm. And looking into the future, how do you see the sub-Saharan continent factoring into world politics, say, the next 20 years down the road?
That's a great question. And the short answer is China. And the reason why I say that is one of the things that's driving Africa's economic growth right now and the rise of the middle class is more engagement by the Chinese, to a lesser extent, India and other kind of middle range powers here. But China's really moving into Africa. It's moving into Africa, striking deals to revitalize ports or harbors, to build infrastructural programs and projects in order to get access to oil, to get access to natural resources. They're providing a substantial amount of development aid. They actually built the entire headquarters for the African Union, which is now in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, as a gift to the African continent. So they're positioning themselves as a viable alternative to the West, to the United States and to the Europeans. And one of the things that they're doing is they're giving aid without any conditionalities, right? The West, for a long time, has tied all sorts of conditionalities to any kind of aid package that's going to Africa, whether it was structural adjustment programs through the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. China's just giving money, you know, without any strings attached. Just be my friend and here's some money, which makes them an incredibly valuable ally for Africa because now Africans can during the Cold War, they were able to play the United States and the Soviet Unions off of each other. Since then, they can't do that. Now they have another option, another alternative. So I expect to see Africa continuing to be of increasing geopolitical and geoeconomic importance, especially as the United States and China kind of vie for standing on the global stage.
Let me get to the three questions. What's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Oh, I came up with no good answer. Revelations. I don't know. I'm in a very strange position. I'm feeling myself getting older, but yet still feeling young. So I'm not sure what we would call that chapter.
Second, what's your worst trait?
My worst trait is I can't say no to things. So I over schedule and overstretch myself, which means that I try and do everything, and which means I don't do anything quite well.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
I'm currently up to be a full professor at my institution, which that strikes me as incredibly odd and surprising because I didn't go into this as a career. And here I am as the end at my career. As well. There's no place to go higher except to retire from this stage.
That was Kevin Dunn. His recent book is Inside African Politics. Kevin, thanks much for talking with me.
Thank you very much, Grant. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Grant Reher. Join me again next week on WRVO Public Media for more conversation in the public interest. You can also follow us on Twitter at Campbell Convos.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Research assistance was provided by Brooke Weinstein. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. Visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations for more information.